I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is a meeting in New York today that may be of some considerable interest to the United States. Or not. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has called together key members of the Security Council, along with nations bordering Iraq, to see if he can once again get the UN back in the game of rebuilding Iraq. The meeting comes after a weekend when a dozen foreigners were killed in that country, and at a time when people who live in the countries where those people come from, Spain, Japan, South Korea, and Colombia, are wondering if their nation should continue working in Iraq with the American forces. These questions cut directly to the principal issues raised by the U.S. diplomat in charge of human rights in the 1990s, Ambassador John Shattuck, says the current occupation of Iraq tears apart the principles of internationalism and safeguarding human rights that were built in the years since the end of the Cold War. Now, we'd like to hear from you on this. Is the international push for human rights really the most important measure for resolving conflict? Is now the time to push once again for UN involvement in Iraq? Or has 9/11 really changed all the rules? Will human rights have to take a back seat to ridding the world of terrorism? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be talking with John Shattuck in just a moment. First, though, a chance to get caught up on the latest news from Iraq. For that, we go to Time magazine reporter Brian Bennett. He's joining us on the phone from Baghdad. Hello, Brian.
Hi, good to be with you.
Brian, the news this morning in America, of course, is of the 50-some-odd Iraqis killed in the fight in that town of Samarra. Is that being seen where you are as a significant shift in U.S. military strategy?
I think it's definitely being seen as a shift in the strategy of the insurgents. A large infantry ambush like this hasn't been waged since the major push of the conflict. And to have reportedly 40 or 50, if not more, organized resistance members, some of them former Saddam Fedayeen fighters, sitting in wait for an American convoy with RPGs and other weaponry, is a change in the tactics of the resistance.
Though any hint, though, Brian, that the American forces were better prepared to deal with the ambush here?
I spoke with an American intelligence official today who said that the Americans were tipped off. There were two ambushes today in Samarra, one smaller ambush and this larger ambush, and the Americans were tipped off beforehand that the larger ambush was going to happen, and so were able to be much better armed. They had tanks in the convoy that was carrying supply of new Iraqi dinar into the city, and also some Bradleys, which is an incredible amount of firepower to go up against effectively light infantry.
Brian, we'll be spending the balance of our hour today talking about the international involvement in Iraq. And we'll just quickly look at the list here. On Saturday, 7 Spanish intelligence officers killed, 2 Japanese diplomats and a Colombian contractor. On Sunday, 2 South Korean contractors also killed. Tell me how that's being seen in Baghdad, the attacks on the foreigners who are trying to work with the Americans, with the Iraqis.
I think it's incredibly disconcerting for foreigners who travel around the city, around Baghdad, and the surrounding area, to think that as the Japanese and Korean convoys were ambushed, that someone who looks like a foreigner or non-Iraqi is at risk of being ambushed and attacked is a dangerous shift in the climate here.
But is it being seen as something specifically aimed at discouraging other countries from joining with the United States, or in a broad sense, just an act to show that the foreigners, whether they be Americans or anyone else, are not going to have the freedom to work in that country?
Certainly the attack on, for example, the Spanish intelligence officers, which seemed to be a set-up ambush. I spoke with the American intelligence officer today who said that a person had come in off the street saying they had intelligence and taken those convinced some of those Spanish intelligence officers to go out with him. They went out and were then ambushed. A situation like that shows a clear targeting of the other coalition members inside Iraq, and trying to encourage the people in the countries of the coalition to try to convince their governments to leave Iraq by the resistance. I think some of the other incidents, like the Japanese workers who were going up to a relief conference in Mosul, that were attacked in Tikrit, their attack, I think, is more along the lines of a random act of violence against the presence of foreigners in the country.
Brian, thanks a lot for being with us. Keep your head down, okay?
Thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
Brian Bennett is a Time magazine reporter joining us on the phone from Baghdad. With me in the studio now, John Shattuck. People in the Boston area know him well as the chief executive officer of the JF Kennedy Library Foundation. He's here with a brand new book called Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. John, nice to have you back in the studio.
Very glad to be here, Dick.
And when you listen to Brian's description of the specific attacks on the folks who are working with the Americans from other countries, this in many ways plays quite directly into a case that you're making in the book about the original plan in Iraq.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the tragedies of Iraq is that the lessons of the wars of the 1990s, which in some ways were similar, wars in Bosnia, Kosovo, the activity in East Timor. The lessons there, I think, there are two major ones that seem not to have been learned. First, to be successful in a humanitarian intervention, and that's what the Bush administration is characterizing this intervention now, even though initially it was proclaimed to be in search of weapons of mass destruction, to be successful in such an intervention, you have to do it in a multilateral fashion. You have to have the UN and other international agencies play a major role, particularly in the reconstruction period, but also in the initial intervention period. And second, you need to have a legitimate authority on the ground that can work with the intervening forces to establish order. And if there isn't such an authority, it needs to be developed. And what we see in Iraq is a largely up till now unilateral intervention with a few friends involved who are now paying very high prices, obviously, as the weekend's events indicates, and no authority on the ground, and the U.S. seen as an occupying force, which isn't really able to provide the legitimate authority that's needed.
Okay, but let's take them one at a time, because the Americans are there with allies. They're there with the British. They're there with a small group of soldiers from Spain, from Italy, from Poland, and hoping to get Japanese soldiers in. It's not like the U.S. is all alone. And every time we hear the president or anyone else in the administration talk about what's going on in Iraq, they don't talk about American forces. They talk about the coalition. The coalition is doing this. The coalition is doing that. I understand that there's political spin to that, but it's not a lie. There are other countries in there.
No, it's certainly true. There are other countries in there, and they've come in, as I said, bravely behind this relatively unilateral intervention that took place back in March. But now is the time to legitimate their participation and broaden it. And it's very much in the U.S. interest to do so now. We need help in peacekeeping. We are being targeted ourselves, as we know from the high price U.S. forces are paying on the ground. We are seen to be an occupying power. And the legitimacy of an international presence mandated by the United Nations simply doesn't exist. And so it's very much in the interests of the U.S. to work with the U.N. to develop a broad mandate for U.N. participation in the peacekeeping and in the reconstruction. We need more troops, for example, and those troops shouldn't come from the United States. We cannot afford to lose this.
The other point that you said that needed to be in place, though, is there needs to be a legitimate authority on the ground. Now, we know about the Iraqi Governing Council. We know about all the pushing and pulling and yelling and closed-door fighting to try and give that organization some degree of authority. Can the Bush administration really be criticized for its efforts to try and get some power, some exercise of power into the hands of Iraqis, given what they were replacing?
Well, the tragedy and the terrible miscalculation here was that the Bush administration seems to have thought that a handful of Iraqi exiles who hadn't been in the country for many years would be able to return and develop around themselves a legitimate authority. That simply hasn't proven to be true, and many people warned at the outset that that wouldn't be true. It was a visionary approach which was totally out of sync with reality. So now clearly they're faced with forming a governing council and then developing a set of legitimate institutions through elections, ultimately, and through participation by the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people don't feel that there is, I think, and clearly you're more of an expert on this, having recently been there frequently, and I think your programs are wonderful in that regard. But I don't believe the Iraqi people feel that the United States is more than an occupying power. They don't have a sense that it is a legitimate source of authority. The United Nations, on the other hand, would certainly be such a source.
We'll talk a little bit more about that later in the program, because that's a key element of the kind of transition that you're calling for. But John, in your book, Freedom on Fire, you're making the case very strongly that human rights priorities need to be at the very top. And I mean, we're hearing a lot about that from the Bush administration these days, that the longer this occupation lasts, the more we know about mass graves, the more people are being able to sort of come out and speak freely and take part in a free press and that sort of thing. And so doesn't that fit into a continuum that was started in the 1990s of international involvement, at least looking at human rights as a priority?
Well, I think half of it does, and the other half clearly doesn't. I celebrate, as certainly all Iraqis of goodwill celebrate, I'm sure, the end of the Saddam Hussein regime and the end of the reign of terror that he was conducting. On the other hand, the means by which that was accomplished, again, ignore the lessons of the 1990s about how humanitarian intervention can be executed, how it can be successfully done, not only with a multilateral approach, but also looking very much to see whether or not it is going to provoke a wider war. Can you bring in countries from the region to participate? In this regard, I think the meeting today that you mentioned is very important, that the Kofi Annan has called together Security Council members and regional states, Syria and others from around Iraq. That was simply ignored at the outset. And so I think the effort to promote human rights through international work, which certainly shouldn't always be military by any means. There ought to be many ways that preventive and action and containment can be more effectively used than has been the case in Iraq. But that's an important element, to be sure.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation as we take a look at the United States' position in Iraq and whether or not there is time and space and an opportunity for making that a more multilateral effort. When we come back after the break, we'll be talking with Jim Wurst, who is New York correspondent for UN Wire, and he'll have the latest on what's happening at the UN on this specific subject. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, for you to join our conversation this hour about the U.S. role in Iraq and whether or not it should be more multilateral. I began the program by talking about a meeting that is taking place later this afternoon in New York. Kuwait, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, all invited by the Secretary General Kofi Annan, along with Egypt and a majority of members of the Security Council, to talk about about issues concerning Iraq. It is, in many ways, the first time that Iraq has been back on the UN agenda. But to help us make a little bit more sense of exactly what's happening in that city, Jim Wirst is joining us on the phone from the United Nations. As I mentioned, he is New York correspondent for UN Wire. It's a news agency that covers the UN and is affiliated with the National Journal. Jim, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Is this a big deal, this meeting this afternoon, or is this more of a keeping people up to date with what's going on?
It's the beginning of a big deal, I think, because the fundamental issue here is over and over again the UN role in the reconstruction and the transition in Iraq. And this is Annan's latest attempt to try to have a little more input into this outside of the Security Council. She said that this advisory board is made up of council members plus the countries that neighbor Iraq in the case of Syria, and that is the same, that they're both a neighbor and a council member plus Egypt. So you've got I believe you've got five permanent members, five elected members plus, as I say, the neighboring countries. So this is trying to take the issue outside the confines of the Security Council and try to give it a broader scope. But, of course, as an advisory board, I mean, it doesn't have any, you know, they're not going to make a decision, but it's trying to try to deal with the fundamental issue of the UN role in Iraq outside the council debate.
But, I mean, Jim, as you point out, the five permanent members of the Security Council are going to be there. One of them is the United States. Does that mean that this may be some kind of backdoor way of reopening communications that between Secretary of State Colin Powell and the UN?
No, the communications have never been cut off. I mean, they're constant contact. Both Powell and Annan stress how much they get along personally and how much respect they have for each other. Annan went to Washington last week or the week before to talk to Powell. So the lines of communication are always there. That's the results that mm-hmm. are lacking.
And John Shattuck, you've been an ambassador. In your view, do you think that the UN can create any kind of momentum to encourage the U.S. back into that forum, or does something also have to come more specifically from the Bush administration, from Colin Powell?
I think it's a two-way street. The U.N., and I certainly salute Secretary General Kofi Annan for taking the lead here, the U.N. can bring together countries and look closely at the issues that need to be addressed now in Iraq. But the U.S. Needs to lead. It needs to lead in a multilateral way. It's been leading in a very unilateral way up till now, essentially saying the U.N. isn't welcome. I think there are several things the United States has to do. First of all, it has to agree to work with the U.N. directly on the political arrangements and the development of a legitimate authority in Iraq. The Iraqi Governing Council right now is perceived to be an entirely U.S. creation, and again, I think it needs to be broadened, and the prospect of developing broader institutions that have legitimacy and U.N. support is clear.
Let me just stop you on that for a minute, John, because, Jim, wasn't there a deadline 2 weeks from now where the Governing Council was supposed to present a plan to the United Nations?
Yes, there was. It's a resolution that passed in October, gave a deadline of December 15th. It required the Council to provide, the Governing Council to provide the Security Council with a timetable and program.
And is that still on or not?
The Constitution, yeah. They sent a letter, the Governing Council sent a letter last week, November 24th, saying here's our timetable, and asking you asked us to do this, here it is, and we're asking for a new Security Council resolution to endorse this. But within days, people started backpedaling, saying, "Well, wait, the U.S. was saying that other members of the Governing Council were saying, well, no, this was still a working paper, this wasn't supposed to be submitted to the Council, et cetera, et cetera." So it's a little bit ambiguous, but the fact of the matter is this letter is here, it exists. It was formally submitted and formally accepted, so they've fulfilled the requirement of a deadline for writing the Constitution and conducting elections. The problem is that they've also asked for a resolution, and the U.S. isn't especially fond of the idea of another resolution right now.
Yeah, I think the problem is that the U.S. is not sent the signal that Security Council members and others need to receive, which is that we really want the U.N. involved actively in political decision-making to develop a legitimate authority. I think the U.S. has also not been willing to send a broader signal, which it may not ever send, at least during the life of this administration, and that is that it does not intend to engage in another unilateral preemptive intervention. That, I think, is sticking in the craw of almost all the other Security Council members, with the exception of Great Britain. And then third, I think the U.S. needs to send a very practical signal that the reconstruction of Iraq is going to be truly international, and that international business, for example, will have an opportunity to bid on contracts for reconstruction, and that the whole reconstruction effort will be genuinely international. Certainly in our interest to do that, given the $87 billion price tag that's attached to it right now.
Jim, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I just wanted to add two quick points to that. One is, yes, I agree, but the other thing is that when he made the exception for Great Britain, I think that might even be giving too much breath to an international coalition, because when the U.S. started making noises about looking at Syria, the U.K. said, no, we're not going to do this again. And the other point is, again, is correct, you know, about the idea of not sending the signal of engagement. This letter from the Governing Council has nothing in it about a role at all for the U.N. So, again, every opportunity they have to signal a willingness to expand, they don't send that signal.
Jim, just one more question from me, and that is whether or not the U.N. has it within its powers to, in effect, punish the United States by refusing to return to Baghdad in any way, saying, look, you know, if you guys are going to claim that you're going to be in charge there and provide a certain amount of security, we want to see a certain level of security before we reopen headquarters, before we get back into the sort of business that we were in. I don't know whether or not that's something that's ever talked about outwardly, but sort of behind the scenes, is there part of that there?
Punish is kind of a strong word. I mean, nobody punishes the United States, and the UN definitely doesn't punish many countries, and particularly not a permanent member of the Security Council. But yes, I mean, Annan has the mandate in the Security Council resolutions that have been passed authorizing somewhat larger role for him. You know, everything is qualified on Annan deciding that security permits. And right now, nobody would believe the security permits it. So, yes, he can withhold return of staff as long as he deems it necessary.
I'd put it another way, just very quickly, and that is that I think the U.N. Is essentially waiting to be told that the U.S. is genuinely willing to participate, to have the U.N. participate. And so far, the U.N. has not been told that. And I don't think we're going to get the result that we desperately need, the U.S., that is, by having the U.N. involved until we send those signals. And I've told you what they should be.
All right. Jim Wirst, thanks for being with us on the program today.
You're welcome.
Jim is New York correspondent for U.N. Wire. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And I'm here in the studio with John Shattuck. We're talking about the international push for human rights started in the years after the end of the Cold War, and whether or not that push remains the most important measure for resolving conflict, or whether or not 9/11 changed the rules. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-423-8255. To Raleigh, North Carolina now, Francis has been waiting on the line. Hi, Francis.
Yes, good morning. I've been listening to your speakers, and I think they are all hurtling at full tilt down the wrong set of tracks. There are no universal human rights. Period. And this mechanism that you keep clinging to, the United Nations, as some top gun that's going to go howling across borders and give everybody whatever it is they think they're reasonably entitled to, is absolute nonsense.
Let's take the UN out of it for just the first part of our
sure,
conversation, Francis, if you like. Because
I'd like to take the U.S. out of it altogether, but go right ahead.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean when you say there is no such thing as a universal understanding of human rights.
You look at our Constitution, all right? That's how we run. That's where our laws come from. You go to Djibouti or you go to Monaco, or you go to Liechtenstein or Andorra or Brazil, a completely different concept altogether. What we're trying to do is take this Constitution, run around and say, gee, it sure would be swell if, you know, if you had the right to free speech, the right to keep and bear arms, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't. The reason that we have them here is because our founding fathers believed in them hard enough to risk their lives, their sacred honor, and their fortunes to fight and to kill to protect them. Now, we're in Baghdad not because they flew their planes into the Eiffel Tower or into Big Ben. We, the United States of America, were attacked. This concept of unilateralism is nonsense. We've lost every single war that we've engaged in that we've had the UN, quote, on our side.
You're not saying that Iraqis flew planes into the World Trade Center towers?
No, I'm talking about the war against terrorism.
Yeah, okay.
And that the preemptive strike that put a stop to the next one, at least for the time being. And I think I have yet to see anyone here, any one of your commentators, sit down and enumerate those universal rights and then tell me or anyone else who's going to pay for it and how many buckets of blood have to be spilled for it.
Well, let's give John Shattuck a chance to do that, Francis.
We'll handle the situation in Iraq by ourselves.
Hang on, Francis. Let's let John Shattuck have a chance at that one.
Well, I think the way to start this conversation, and we obviously could talk at great length about this, but the way to have a brief conversation is to point to what happened in the Second World War, out of which the whole human rights movement developed, and that was genocide and crimes against humanity were committed against, in this instance, Jews in Germany, but there were many other crimes against humanity that were committed. Above all, I think what we have is a universal agreement that those acts of genocide, killings by people because of their against other people because of their ethnic or racial or religious background, or killings by governments, are illegal. They are performed, to be sure. And I would point to five instances in which the success of the United States in stopping those crimes recently was a result of working together with other countries and with the support of the United Nations.
Sir?
Bosnia, Kosovo, East Timor, Haiti, and Afghanistan, which was most recently the nature of the intervention. I think there's no evidence that the U.S. was under attack by Iraq. It's certainly true that there were human rights abuses being committed in Iraq. And I think it's a tragedy that we went into Iraq the way we did, because I think the prospect of bringing stability to that country has been made much less as a result of the unilateral nature of our intervention.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Francis.
Yes, sir. First of all, I thought the reason we got into World War II was because of Pearl Harbor. I thought the reason the Japanese went into Manchuria was to conquer it and to attack Indonesia and seize their oil fields. I thought the reason that Germany went into Poland was Liebenstrom.
I think what John's talking about is that the lessons after the Second World War and what the world looked at had happened at that point was in...
If I may, the lesson, sir, that we have learned, we had to go to Normandy and kill 5,000 men in one day, because the French surrendered to the Germans where they outnumbered them at the Maginot Line and could have put an end to World War II. It is this indecisive nonsense. It is this unsubstantiated dream that one day we're all going to hold hands in a field full of daisies and get along just fine. That is nonsense.
So you're saying that there should never be any principles of human rights? You think,
sir,
that it's a pipe dream to imagine that it could ever happen?
I speak to you now because I am an American, and those people that came before me fought and died so that I can speak to you now without fear of reprisal. I have them. Let that individual in Djibouti, if he seeks freedom, which not all people do, if he seeks freedom and that liberty, let him put his life on the line as my ancestors did and earn it. It is not a gift, sir.
And neither is it the responsibility, then, of the United States to see that those human rights are made a priority anywhere but this country. Is that what you're saying?
Let me use my own words, if I may. I think we will support those people who believe and live for the things that we believe and live for. And we shall deny, as we should Red China, those countries that brutalize and savage their own people. That is what I believe America should do.
I think, John Shattuck, what you're saying through your list of Bosnia and Kosovo and East Timor, Haiti and Afghanistan is that in each one of those conflicts, the United States and other countries, the United Nations, NATO, depending on who was ever in charge, was in fact trying to find partners in those countries who did place a value on human rights or did place a value on freedom. I think Francis is probably right. If you go into a place where it's utter lawlessness and chaos and nobody has the time to worry about that, you can't impose that sort of thing.
No, I think that's right. That is indeed one of the lessons of those wars that I described, and I describe it in my book. And I fear that it's a lesson that we did not learn very well before we went into Iraq, which is not to say that there aren't millions of Iraqis who want their freedom, but there was no legitimate partner in Iraq. We're now having to try to create one.
Where would a legitimate partner in Iraq come from? It's like saying there'd be no legitimate partner in North Korea. I mean, the leadership of that country has made it its own business to make sure that there would be no legitimate partner. So what do you do?
No, I think what you do is work to develop ways for the Iraqi people to express their views of who their government should be. And I think that's what we are doing. We're trying to do that. We're running into a lot of difficulty with it, though, because we're doing it alone. We need the help of other countries. We need the legitimacy of the United Nations to be able to develop the kind of sovereign Iraqi authority that can take over and stabilize the country.
All right, Francis, thanks for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, John Shattuck, his new book is called Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. It, in effect, takes you through his own experience through the 1990s, taking a look at Rwanda and Haiti and Bosnia and Kosovo and East Timor and the experience that was learned in building some kind of international consensus on human rights. It's also his contention that consensus is under serious threat when a country as large and powerful as the United States goes unilaterally into a country like Iraq. We'd like to hear from you on that. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, John Shattuck. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights under the Clinton administration, was also U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic, and he has a new book out looking back at his time through the 1990s working on issues of human rights for the Clinton administration. It's called Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Arlington, Massachusetts. Fred, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm a little disappointed that we as Americans still believe that we only do good and don't do any harm to anybody. Let's talk about human rights. First of all, we start the problem in Timor, which this man wrote the book on. It was Kissinger and Ford that gave the Indonesians the go-ahead to do it. The whole world no longer believes in us. All the polls have shown that they don't trust us, and we'll be basically irrelevant to them. We're just a threat now for peace. That's what the shows show. We, in South America, there are thousands of mass graves with our fingerprints on them. We have committed war crimes such as the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which was not a war zone, was just civilians. We never face our own war crimes. As a matter of fact, we don't want to join any international court because we're afraid to be caught on it. You know, it's about time we, as 4% of the world's population, meet our responsibilities and face the facts. We have a lot of dirty underwear, to be cleaned. We ought to talk about it, too. It's very easy to go to these other countries and say we are there for good reasons and destroy them and bomb them to ashes, you know?
But are you saying, though, Fred, that because the United States has great hampers of dirty laundry in its past, that it is no longer that it does not have the standing, the right to say anything to any other nation about you know, the way things ought to work?
Because these other nations, they feel they are in a better position to deal with these problems. They feel they have a better past to deal with them.
Well, let's talk about Iraq, though. I mean, the people in Iraq weren't able to do anything about life under Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, the people in Iraq, well, these are plenty of countries out there that people cannot do much, you know, and we have helped a lot of these countries. People under Pinochet could not have done much. We put them in power. You know, he killed thousands of his own people.
I don't think John Shattuck's going to disagree with you here. I mean, one of the points that he makes in the book, and I'll let him pick it up, is that it's the lack of consistency in the United States that, John, works against this country more than anything else.
Well, it is obviously a lack of consistency when you're looking at something as broad as human rights and the U.S. is acting often on its own interests. And I think this makes the point that I make very broadly throughout the book, which is that the United States should not act alone. We don't have the sole authority to look at human rights and say, here's where they should be enforced. We should work with other countries. We should work within a framework of international law. I don't disagree with your caller that there are times in U.S. history when certainly we have acted in a way that, looking back, suggests that we violated human rights in various instances, which is another reason to work multilaterally through international organizations and international law.
But you write about the time when President Clinton decided to maintain China's most favored nation trading status at a time when you and other people in the administration were pounding your fist to saying, you know, you've got to link human rights to this. If you don't, you're going to make fools of us. And you came close to resigning when he went the other direction.
Well, this is a very, very difficult time, I think. And the fact that I and others were out enforcing a policy of linking human rights to trade, which had in fact been adopted by the administration earlier, and then that was reversed, made it especially complicated for those of us who were working on the human rights portfolio. But the broad point I want to make here is that in the case of China, the U.S. has many interests, to be sure. It has interests, economic interests, security interests, human rights interests, environmental interests, et cetera. And sometimes those interests clash. In fact, frequently they do. Sometimes human rights ends up on the short end of the stick, as it did in China. And that's precisely why the U.S., whenever it possibly can, should work with other countries to develop a consensus about when and where human rights should be pursued and enforced. And I think to deal with cases of genocide and crimes against humanity, as we did in the case of Bosnia and Kosovo, as we tragically did not in the case of Rwanda, are examples of what the U.S. ought to be doing with other countries to enforce human rights.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Norfolk, Virginia. David, you're with us. Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just want to comment. My experience, I am a military officer, and my experience with working with coalition troops is that when we make the coalition large and try to include Pakistanis, even Italians in our coalition, we end up with a not very effective fighting force because these other countries do not have the level of professionalism that we have, that the Brits have, that the French have. And in some cases, especially Somalia, my experience is that the Italians and the Pakistanis were an undermining force. So I think when we say we just need a coalition, we need to be more careful in picking who our partners are, not just putting out this large net and saying, everyone come help us out.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a good point here. I mean, certainly it is very complicated to put together a multinational military force. It has been done successfully. It was done in the case, I think, of Bosnia in terms of the peacekeeping operation, a very robust one that finally came in following NATO intervention there. I was in Congo this summer, and I had the opportunity to review and observe the UN peacekeeping operation that was going on there without any U.S. participation. It was complicated, I think successful, but I fear that it might not have worked if there were a real military challenge that it faced. So I think there is a trade-off here between military professionalism on the one hand and international legitimacy on the other. And you've got to find a balance to put the two together. And I think the U.S. can rightly lead in finding that balance and has done so successfully in Bosnia and Kosovo.
I mean, David, if you were to imagine in Iraq, for example, several thousand military police from Pakistan, Muslim men with guns trying to find some kind of common ground there. Do you think that that what's lost in the professionalism that John's describing might be balanced out by what's gained in having people closer to Iraq taking part in the rebuilding and reconstruction?
The experience I have from coworkers of mine that worked directly with the Pakistanis in Somalia is that they were cowards. And, you know, when the whole Black Hawk Down situation happened, they're saying, go Pakistanis, go. Pakistanis said, no, I'm not going. So I don't know if they've become more professional now. I myself have not worked in Iraq, although I have coworkers that do. And I think the consensus, well, I can't say consensus, but the opinion is Pakistanis are not good troops. I also want to point out, NATO and the United Nations are completely different. NATO has much more influence by the United States and is a professional organization, much more so than all these UN peacekeeping organizations.
David, thanks for your call.
I appreciate it.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, and Randy's with us. Hi, Randy, go ahead.
Yes, I agree with one of your earlier callers very much about really the blood on our hands and that it's lack of credibility that we have going in unilaterally when, at least under what I view as a pretext of human rights, considering that we often have created the conditions, you know, for example, with the Shah of Iran and the human rights abuses there are basically enabling Saddam Hussein to be in power and providing him with chemical weapons
Let's talk about going forward.
I think that means you have to, I mean, we can't change, you know, the fact that we participated or enabled a lot of those things. But going forward, for us to have credibility, we have to start following a single standard and stop supporting governments such as Israel that commits human rights abuses.
Does that single standard have to come from something like the United Nations?
I think it does. And it has to be something that we is enforced on us and that we're willing to, you know, abide by. I don't think unilaterally we have that ability. There are too many special interest groups in this country and special interest may be the wrong word, but, you know, when you have things like AIPAC that support Israel in commuting its human rights abuses, the energy people that, you know, put other goals ahead of human rights. And ultimately, I think you need an outside organization such as the United Nations to restore that credibility.
I want to actually take the center point of what you're saying, Randy, and bring John in on this, because it's, I don't know whether or not the word lack of consistency or the phrase lack of consistency works, but I mean, you're arguing for the United States to be more involved in these multilateral organizations, which have a moderating effect on U.S. politics. But you know that you can't ever take out of the equation U.S. politics, and that if people like what George Bush is doing, they're going to vote him back into office. There'll be another 4 years of the type of you know, unilateral or U.S. first leadership that we're seeing now, and then that will or that won't change depending on how voters feel about it. So how do you take all the domestic pressures that come to putting an administration into power and present that to the rest of the world as anything that's, you know, that's consistent? I don't see how you can do it.
Well, I think you can't be starry-eyed about any of this. The United Nations is made up of all of the countries that are members of it, and the United States is the most important country because it pays the largest portion of the dues and is the most powerful country in the world today. So realpolitik is going to play a big role in this, to be sure. But I think the way we've shifted the pendulum now so far over to essentially say we don't trust any of these international groupings and even coalitions such as NATO to do the things that we think we should do in our own in our own view of what our interests are, I think that's made the world less secure, and it's made Americans more vulnerable. It's certainly made them more vulnerable in Iraq. I think it is, and in this sense, I think American politics is now going to work hard to try to multilateralize, bring in more international troops and peacekeepers and reconstruction aid. Americans are not at all pleased with the $87 billion price tag that they've been presented for this unilateral war, and they certainly are increasingly concerned about the number of casualties that Americans are facing. So there is a domestic impetus, if you will, for internationalizing what's happening in Iraq right now, and I think the Bush administration should pay attention to that.
I mean, one of the points that you make in the book through your own travels is that it is issues like poverty and underdevelopment, the sort of failed state status of a lot of these places, which in many ways contributes to people who would want to, you know, become terrorists. Can you see that becoming a part of the U.S. understanding of the world?
Well, I think it needs to become a part of it. I think this is why I argue that human rights in many ways are more important now than ever, because the swamps of Afghanistan and the terrible human rights abuses occurring in countries from which terrorism emerges are the kinds of issues that we need to pay more attention to than we did earlier. We cannot allow, again, a genocide to occur as occurred in Rwanda. It is in our interest to stabilize Central Africa and certainly to save the lives of 800,000 people who were killed there, just as it is in our interest to drain the swamps of human rights abuse in Afghanistan and ultimately Iraq, working with the rest of the world, so that these are not hotbeds of terrorism as they are now. But doing it the way this administration is going about it, I'm afraid, is seriously counterproductive. Whatever rhetoric may be attached in terms of human rights to what they claim they're trying to do.
John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks.
John Shattuck is Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, author of a new book called Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. Earlier in the program, we spoke with Time magazine reporter Brian Bennett in Baghdad, Jim Wurst, correspondent for UN Wire, a news agency that covers the United Nations. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.